Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The court has three causes for submission on the oral docket this morning. In the order of the presentation, they are as follows: Sam and Carol Moraz versus Jerry Odom and Odom Investments Incorporated in El Paso County. Richard A. Caballero versus Central Power and Light from Maverick County. Amy Upshaw and others versus the Trinity Companies from Bexar County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience. You may make application to hear these arguments with our clerk if you so desire. The court will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument, but will complete the docket before taking a lunch break. Justice Hightower will be arriving sometime toward the end of this argument or in time for the second argument, and he will participate in the deliberation and decision in all three of these causes. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner Sam Moraz versus Odom.
May it please the court. Mr. Severson will present argument for the petitioners.
Your honors, may it please the court. My name is Jerry Severson. I'm here from El Paso County representing the petitioners. This is a very simple case, frankly, and it boils down to whether or not under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, a consumer can recover damages which do not necessarily arise at the time of transaction. Although I'm certainly aware that the court is familiar with the factual background of the case, I'd like to take just a few brief moments to kind of summarize the facts of this case. In 1984, Mr. Odom approached Mr. Sam Moraz and his wife, Carol Moraz. Mr. Moraz was a draftsman. Indicated that Mr. Moraz would be wise for him to buy this property in El Paso that had an old house on it. It was basically three lots. With the thought of remodeling it, selling it, that he could make enough money off the sale of the one remodeled house and the lot to pay for the back lots. Mr. Moraz and Carol Moraz did, in fact, buy the property. He remodeled it. It took approximately 2 years to remodel it. When he went to sell the house, it was discovered at that time for the first time by Mr. Moraz and Carol Moraz that the house, in fact, encroached over the boundary line and sat on what's common in El Paso, basically an irrigation ditch of unknown ownership, and it could not be determined who owned the property. With regard to that, he immediately went to a lawyer in El Paso. That lawyer researched it, tried to figure out whether or not the problem could be remedied. As a result of the encroachment, the buyer backed out of the purchase. The purchase price for the home was $225,000. At that time, there was owed on the note borrowed from the bank, as well as accumulated interest, commissions, and closing costs. There would have been paid approximately $208,000. So that if Mr. Moraz and his wife would have been able to close the project, they would have walked away from the property at that point with $17,000. When it was not closed, the bank immediately foreclosed upon the property, not only that one lot, but the two back lots as well. Additionally, the bank foreclosed upon another lot that Mr. Moraz had had to put up as collateral for a $15,000 loan, the value of that other lot being $40,000. The Morazes did not know about the encroachment, although it was shown that it was that the encroachment problem was known by Mr. Odom. In fact, he had an appraisal done before he even sold the house to the Moraces showing that there was an encroachment. And furthermore, he had gave that appraisal to the bank showing the encroachment. However, none of these parties informed Mr. and Mrs. Moraz. Mr. Odom was responsible for arranging the financing for the project. The 8th Court of Appeals has ruled that in order for, and I would quote their opinion, for there to be any actual damages recoverable under the DTPA, there must have been evidence showing the amount of actual damages that occurred at the time of purchase, not after the improvements had been made on the property resulting in a sale falling through more than 2 years later. The Moraces did not offer any evidence as to benefit of the bargain or out-of-pocket measure of damages at the time the transaction with the appellant was closed. And that is the basic reason we're here. We feel that's contrary to the case Miller versus Bynum, which is currently here. I believe the arguments were supposed to have been heard on September 17th of 1991 on some points of error that had been granted. However, those points of error did not apply to this. This is the case that had to do with whether or not a party needs to identify, a party needs to identify themselves as being a person with knowledge of relevant facts. And quite candidly, I've not seen that that's been ruled on. That case is, I believe, currently still up here with the court. But the way I understand it, the issues with regard to damages are not before the court, although I certainly understand you could look at the whole case. That case indicated that you look at the net economic loss suffered by the consumer, and that is certainly what we have in this particular case. We believe that the El Paso Court of Appeals was in error because it's contrary to the statute, Except the Trade Practices Consumer Protection Act, which allows for recovery of all actual damages. We believe it's contrary to the Bynum case, which has previously been cited. We also believe that it's contrary to a case decided by the El Paso court itself, although it was a 1960 case, and I would cite this case to the court because it's not been cited in the brief. But it is the El Paso Development Company versus Ravel, R-A-V as in Victor, E-L. It's cited at 339 Second, 360. Writ was refused in R-E. And I think this is a very important case because although not brought under the DTPA, obviously actual damages go back to common law damages. And this was a case very quickly, let me just give you a few brief bits of background about it. This was a case where the development company represented to the purchaser that this lot that they would be buying was free of clay and fill dirt, as we have sometimes out in El Paso, that there'd be no problem building on it. The consumer or the purchaser bought the lot. If I could just read from this, from the case, the appellees caused an expensive home to be constructed on the lot in question before discovering the falsity of the representations concerning the subsoil conditions of the lot. Since the value of the lot was not shown to have been affected by the truth or falsity of the representation, the measure of damages allowed by the statute would afford no relief, and neither would the equitable remedy of rescission. Let me first address that. We would not have rescission in our case because, of course, the bank immediately foreclosed upon the property. Plus, rescission would not have made us whole because we've spent substantial sums of money in doing the remodeling. So rescission was not a form of relief that was available to us in this case. Going on to quote from the Ravel case, the Court of Appeals pointed out that the damages which the recipient of a fraudulent representation was entitled to recover was the pecuniary loss shown to have resulted from the falsity of the matter represented, including not only, number one, the difference between the value of the thing obtained and its purchase price or value of the thing exchanged for it, but also, number two, pecuniary loss suffered otherwise as a consequence of the recipient's reliance upon the truth of the representation. And in that case, the Court of Appeals in El Paso itself did award damages, and those damages were measured by the difference in the value of the house after it was constructed, which was $52,500 after constructed, and the jury found it would have only been worth $30,000 because of the soil conditions and because of the problems.
Counsel, so, can you direct us to any part of the record in the case where you introduced evidence of the difference in between the purchase price and the actual value at the time received, at the time of the purchase? In other words, that you introduced evidence of the difference in market value caused by this deceptive trade practice?
At the time of the transaction? Is that the question?
Yes.
No, sir, I did not.
And there were no jury findings on that measure of damages?
No, sir, there were none. In fact, I would concur with Mr. Milligan. The original opinion by the Court of Appeals really had the facts a little bit wrong. We paid $135,000 for the front lot, which had the house, and the two back lots. The total appraised for those three lots was $168,000. So, in fact, we have no proof. The appraised values, by the way, unbeknownst to us, did show that there was an encroachment on it. But the bottom line is we showed no damages as at the time of the purchase. No
and damage. How would you characterize the measure of damages that you did submit to the jury?
I will admit that I'm having a tough time in trying to differentiate direct or general damages versus consequential. The Court of Appeals, of course, referenced the fact that we had, they say no pleadings. I would take issue with that, and that I said as a result of, and I'm not sure that I had to necessarily use the term as a consequence of, but I did have the pleading in there that as a result of this conduct, here are the different elements of damage. The damages is set forth, and by the way, again, with all due respect to the court, since under DTPA, everything that I read indicates that you don't have to show, you wouldn't ask a special issue on consequential damages. So I've been trying to differentiate in my own mind what is a direct damage and a consequential damage in this particular case. Very briefly, some of the facts of the case were that Mr. Odom represented to my client that when he did his building and remodeled the house in accordance with the way he was going to do it, it would have an appraised value of $250,000. That was told to the bank by Mr. Odom in securing the financing. Frankly, it was also told to the appraisal before he even did the appraisal.
There is evidence in the record that those statements were made.
Yes, sir.
And you sued under 1746 and under 1750.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And your cause of action was based upon breach of the warranties represented by that statement?
In part, yes, sir. And I would point out that the appraisal came back unbeknownst to us showing it would only have a value of $229,000, which I think was probably a pretty good appraisal because we ended up with a sales price of $225,000. Had we known that it was $38,000 less than represented, we would not have entered into the transaction. That's part of the damage. The other damages would be the difference in the loss, the $17,000 that we would have walked away at closing with. The Court of Appeals said we didn't prove exactly how much we spent on remodeling the house, and I'm not frankly sure how that's important because the bottom line would have been we at least would have had $17,000. Maybe Mr. Maroff spent too much money on this house, but at least he would have recouped part of it. When he didn't get the $17,000 net, and that would have, by the way, allowed the bank to be paid all its interest on the other notes, including the note that he gave secured by an unrelated lot. We lost the lot with a house on it, the two back lots, the third lot, his car was repossessed. And
yeah, I believe that you're going beyond the scope of the
I beg your pardon?
I believe you're going beyond the scope of the question.
I'm sorry.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Milligan will present argument to the respondent.
May it please the court, I'm Mickey Milligan representing the respondents, Jerry Odom and Odom Investments. The Eighth Court opinion said that consequential damages needed a special issue so for the plaintiffs to recover. The point in this case is there was one special issue, what are actual damages? I have relied on this court's rulings in the Bankston, Nissan, and Leyendecker cases. Bankston, Nissan, this court said it's the plaintiff's burden to introduce the issues on the proper measure of damage, out of pocket or benefit of the bargain. Having failed to do so, the plaintiff's case must fail. And that's been our point consistently since the trial court judgment, through post-trial pleadings, through the appellate court, and right up until now.
Counsel, your opposition says that this issue was submitted in exactly the form you requested. Is that correct?
Yes, Judge. They submitted an issue on actual damages, and in response to theirs, I drafted one because I didn't like theirs. Rule 279, though.
It was your issue that was submitted.
On actual damages, that's right. And Rule 279 says that I do have the right to challenge an issue even if I drafted it based upon no evidence or insufficient evidence. And that's exactly what I did. My point on appeal was there was no evidence of damages in this case. Now, he just stood here and tried to explain how the damages, and to this day, it's almost impossible to tell what it is he's talking about. There are common law theories of damages down through the years, out of pocket and benefit of the bargain. He starts talking about things that happened 2 years after a purchase, and look, figure this in, and the foreclosure was our fault, and all these things, none of which appear in any reported common law theory of damage. The question simply is, was he hurt, and if so, how much was he hurt when he bought the property? And that's where his case fails, because he's never been able to show that. In fact, I pointed out in my response, on a couple of occasions in this case, even in a post-trial brief, he admitted that there were no damages when he bought the land. It happened 2 years later. It's not my client's fault if he had problems 2 years later and didn't finish his house, and then he didn't pay his lender, it got foreclosed on. That is not my client's responsibility.
Do you believe a representation of what something is going to be worth in 2 years can ever be a misrepresentation or a basis for damage?
I don't think so, Judge. I pointed out that 258, may I go over here?
Because there's a lot of numbers being thrown around this case, and it makes it confusing. He keeps talking about $258,000. There is a letter from my client in the record where my client, when he was ready to buy, wrote a letter to an appraiser saying he wants to borrow the money to buy and he wants the remodeling money. Go take an appraisal out and so we can give it to the lender and get a loan. My client said it ought to appraise somewhere around $258,000, but go look at his blueprint and come up with a figure. The appraiser then came back with an appraisal of $229,000. And so you'll see in his brief, he keeps subtracting the difference between my client's letter before purchase and the appraiser's appraisal before purchase, saying that if the plaintiff builds a house like he says he will, it should be worth this amount. There's no evidence in this case he ever built it like he should have. The only evidence is he never finished it. He never finished this house. So therefore, this is meaningless. This, both of these numbers have to do with long after the purchase, if the plaintiff, the petitioner, did what he said he was going to do. My point is, that's one more reason why out-of-pocket or benefit of the bargain on the day of purchase should be the measure.
Well, you admit that the DTPA can encompass consequential damages.
I agree, Judge.
Apart from either of those measures in the proper case.
But I submit that they need special issues. The Court of Appeals didn't say you couldn't get them. They just said if you want them, let's have some issues. If you're going to have some strange damage, like cost of improvements or something like that, submit an issue on it so we all know exactly what you're talking about. And that's what they didn't do. I submit that as a defendant in the trial, I didn't have the burden to come up and submit special issues for them to prove the case.
Counsel, was the jury instructed on the measure of damages?
No, Judge, there was no instructions at all.
Did you object to the absence of an instruction on what you consider to be an appropriate measure?
No, I did not. Again, I'm relying on that Banks and Nissan case where this court said it's their burden to submit it, the plaintiff's burden. Now, let me make one, since we have all these numbers, there was one appraisal at the time of purchase, $168,500. Now let me mention, both of these are in evidence, and both of them say this property had this slight encroachment into this drainage easement, not in the middle of the ditch, just on the edge of the easement. You heard counsel say in El Paso, this is common because we have irrigation from the Rio Grande. It's common, it happens all the time. He didn't raise this problem until 2 years after he bought this property. That's because he hadn't finished building the house. And that's what this case is about. But the proof, the only appraisal when he bought it was this figure. He only paid $135,000 for all the property. The difference is he made a profit based upon the evidence of $33,500. And that's why he won't talk about what the numbers were when he bought. There is no evidence that he got hurt on the day he bought it. All the evidence pertains to 2 years later when he didn't do what he thought he was going to do and what he told this appraiser he was going to do and what he told my client he was going to do.
Are you contesting any of the liability findings by the jury?
Well, I had some points of error that the 8th Court didn't rule on about juror outside influence in those things.
Right, but as far as your client not giving the facts of this encroachment to his to the plaintiffs, or your client not telling the plaintiffs about the amount of this estate, the $129,000 appraisal, I assume those are the facts on the
But that's what he said. Case.
But you're not contesting that either in this court or in the court of appeal.
No, Judge, I didn't. So that's basically the problem here. He's saying that he's talking about losing a sale and those things, and of course, let me mention the evidence in that lost sale from the lady he says he lost it from. Her deposition's in evidence because the court reporter didn't take down her video deposition in front of the jury. She said that encroachment didn't have anything to do with it. I wouldn't have ever bought that house because he didn't finish it and it was in terrible shape. And yet he continues to say, I lost the sale 2 years later. Andra Sherrill's her name, and that's what she said in her deposition. She didn't trust him, and the house wasn't finished. She wouldn't have bought it even had there not been an encroachment. So he has no evidence that he lost the sale. In any event, I submit, going back to a common law theory of damage, there is no Texas common law theory of damage that says if you lose one sale 2 years after you bought property, that constitutes evidence of damage. It's not. And I therefore have to keep going back to the out-of-pocket or benefit of the bargain. Those have been with us a long time, and they determine on the date of purchase whether there was injury and whether there was loss. So I submit there was no real estate case that I could find when we did the research on this that actually dealt with this particular problem. That is, what happens when you buy real estate, you change it, you remodel it, configure it around, and then want to compute damages after you've changed it. I submit that out-of-pocket and benefit of the bargain should be on the day of purchase. The person who sold it, in this case my client, shouldn't be held responsible for what happens when the buyer goes and changes it around and 2 years later say, well, I think I'm going to hold you responsible.
What if your client had said, if completed according to these plans and specifications, it will be worth $258,000, and it was completed according to those plans and specifications, would there be a cause of action under 1746B or 1750?
That's a tougher question. I think I can't imagine, though, when we're talking about future, there's so many variables. I mean, you're saying, I assume, if the exact language of the question, if he absolutely made that warranty, and if it was undisputed that the person absolutely did as he said.
Yes.
That's a close question, but again, I can't see how it should be legally because of the fact that it goes off into the future. What if the promise was 10 years in the future if you did blah, blah? I can't see how we can have valid theories of damage if they're going to be allowed to go off indefinitely in the future. To me, it's got to be at the time of each transaction. So therefore, I don't see that if we ever gotten to that, it would be there would be no limitations that I could see. So I do feel, Your Honor, that it has to be at the time. If it's any sort of future or speculative promise, I can't see it.
1744, construction and application says the subchapter shall be liberally construed to promote the underlying purposes, which are to protect consumers against false, misleading, or deceptive business practices.
Well, it has been liberally construed, but we're talking about the damage theories. I'm not aware of any damage theory that this court, throughout the cases, has ever taken to say you can figure damages based on some remote time in the future. I just feel that it has to be based in time as of the time of the transaction. At the time my man made that representation, what was his damage at that time? Not 5 years or 10 years. Theoretically, under this theory, I suppose he could have built this house, not sold it, sat in it, and 5 years later come back and say, it's not worth it. There's no limit.
What if you overhauled the transmission of his car, the car would be worth $2,000 more than you paid for it?
Well, we're still getting in the future. When? The problem is when? I don't see that you can ever have the parameters to define a common law theory if you're talking about what's going to happen in the future. My feeling about the Deceptive Trade Act is that its purpose was to cure ills in consumer problems, but cure the ills now. If you let it go and apply to remote times in the future, there's no way then we're going to have any definable body of law, to my way of thinking.
I understand.
I would point out that there were a couple of problems with this writ that I wanted the court to be aware of. One is, of course, that the copy of the Court of Appeals opinion is erroneous. And there was the Court of Appeals had some factual mistakes on page 1 and 6 of its original opinion and changed them. Unfortunately, the copy that got attached to the writ of application is the unchanged version. And I wanted to bring that to the attention of the court. I also want to bring to this court's attention on page 13, I was just talking about the $135,000. That was for the house and the lot on which it sat, and the two unimproved lots. Now, there was no encroachment on the two unimproved lots because there was no improvement. But that's the total purchase price, undisputed in the evidence. On page 13, he says that the price, he subtracts $115,000, which was the appraised value of the house, from the $135,000, and says he has a $20,000 out-of-pocket loss. This 168 is made up of three numbers for the house and the lot on which it's at and the other two lots. That's the total. So the court's been mistakenly misled in this brief when he subtracted 115 from 135. It's simply not right. He paid 135 total. The appraisal for all the property he paid for was 168. There is no way to deduct these numbers and show he had a loss on the day he bought it. As far as the other things, he's now come into this court and say in his brief that he's got a loss of credit. I was at the trial, and I don't remember anything being said. There's no evidence about any loss of credit. He didn't point you to any in his brief. He says that this one lawyer he had originally spent some time on trying to fix this encroachment. I submit to you that what little that lawyer said at trial, he specifically said he didn't. And this attorney, the counsel for petitioners, actually said in his final argument he was including that lawyer's time in his fees for handling the deceptive trade case. But now to this court, not in the 8th court, but to this court, he's trying to break them out and desperately trying to come up with some damage that has some basis somewhere. And that's, again, the problem. If they want special consequential damages, there needs to be special issues submitted. Bynum, he keeps talking about, was a non-jury case. This court, I believe, has already heard it.
There's a big difference. You keep saying that there needs to be a special issue on consequential damages. You're saying he can't broadly submit a damage issue in a DTPA case that would include consequential damages?
I don't believe so, Judge, because this court set out-of-pocket or benefit of the bargain for misrepresentation. If you want damages for something other than out-of-pocket or benefit of the bargain, I submit they need to be submitted specially. You don't have to for out-of-pocket or benefit of the bargain. The actual damage issue we had required no further instruction so long as the damage was going to be out-of-pocket or benefit of the bargain. If he wanted something other than those two theories, he had to have a special issue to the jury. And so there simply was no damage approved at the time of this purchase, and he's come back trying to say that somehow to shove something in. Please note that there's no record reference when he lists these things. He mentions this Bynum case. Of course, that case had something to do with not disposing a witness on interrogatories. It was also non-jury. A non-jury case is totally different. There are no special issues to the court, and the court has the right to decide the damages in its discretion and then enters findings of fact. To my way of thinking, there's no comparison to compare what the Bynum court may have done on damage, which was non-jury, and this case. That's all I have. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
If I might, first of all, respond to a few of the factual matters that Mr. Milligan asserted. He told the court that the house was never completed. That's controverted in the record by the fact that we had a sale. There were admittedly a few punch list items that needed to be done.
Did the prospective buyer in fact say the postman had nothing to do, why am I buying the house?
Judge, in her videotaped deposition taken obviously well after the transaction occurred, she did state that. There were underlying reasons for that that we feel the jury just chose to disbelieve her. The fact of the matter is her lawyer wrote a letter to Mr. Maras's lawyer at the time he was trying to close it saying, we will not close this because you cannot provide us with good, clear title to the property, period. It didn't say she doesn't like the house, it hasn't been completed to her satisfaction. The letter and evidence, in fact, her attorney testified in court. That was the basis given for later, and obviously the jury chose to disregard, and I wish you could see her videotape, but the jury chose to disregard her later claim that it was because the house wasn't completed properly. In fact, she lived in the house for paying rent for a period of time before the closing was to take place. That's the first issue. Mr. Milligan says he's never seen a case on damages such as this in real estate, and I again would urge the court to take a look at the Ravel case out of El Paso. It's almost exactly directly in point.
Is that a DTPA case?
No, sir. But it's a common law fraud case, again, addressing the issue of actual damages. And what that court said was that there was no evidence of the lot being less than what was paid for. Unimproved lot. That's exactly what we have here, and we will acknowledge to the court have no proof that what we paid for it was more than it was worth when we bought it.
How do you respond to the argument that there was an appraised value of $168.5, you paid $135 for it, so you actually made profit of $33.5?
Well, appraised value is merely an appraised value. I understand that. I don't see that we made any profit on this. In fact, we lost. We had to put up a $60,000 CD that we lost. We were sued for $30,000 from the El Paso Federal Bank out there for additional monies that we owed. They're claiming that we owe. That matter was severed and still pending. But we didn't make any profit. Yes, I would acknowledge that the appraised value at the time of the occurrence showed that the value of the lots were more than what we paid for it. my position is that's not the issue. Mr. Milligan continues to say we need to have a separate consequential damages issue submitted to the jury, and yet I'm sitting there asking myself, why? For the only definition that you have, and out of the pattern jury charge, when you have a question submitted to a jury on consequential damages in a breach of contract, of course it talks about foreseeability. You give the jury an instruction as to foreseeability, the natural, flowing, and foreseeable damages. Foreseeability, under the pattern jury charge, no foreseeability required. Proof of foreseeability is not required to recover consequential damages such as lost profits under DTPA, and the pattern jury charge then cites numerous cases along those regards. And obviously the difference there is the proximate cause versus the producing cause. And so I'm asking myself, why would we need to submit a consequential question if foreseeability is not required, as we've been told by the pattern jury charge and by the cases? It does not make any sense to me. I will admit that there were no instructions submitted. However, that is verbatim the way that the instruction was requested in the defendant's first requested jury charge, verbatim. And if Mr. Milligan did not want to have an instruction on there as to instructions regarding elements of damage, that was okay with me, and I never complained about it.
How do you respond that it was your burden under Bankston and Nissan and the other cases that it was your burden to submit any instruction you wanted to or an issue?
I agree with that, and I do also agree that the case law seems to hold and does in fact hold that you do need to have some instructions on proper element of damage. However,
if you don't submit it, you lose.
Well, except that it was his charge as submitted.
How was it his charge if you had the burden? And the cases indicate that a plaintiff has the burden to submit in substantial correct form the issues and instructions under which he can get a judgment.
I understand that. My thinking at that time was that it was his requested charge. The rules clearly say if he doesn't submit it in substantially form, and again, it's not...
But who's relying on the answers?
I understand that, Judge, and I also understand it's not in the record, and I hate to go outside the record.
Well, if it's not in the record, just don't say it.
Well, as to the time the court and the attorney spent coming up with this charge, but regardless, it was his charge as requested, and I don't feel that we should be penalized because he never asked for instructions.
You ought not to be penalized because you got snookered.
That's basically laying behind the log is what I think some of the cases talk about. Yes, sir. It was not submitted that way, and it was proposed, and it looked okay to me, and I didn't have objection to it. It was proposed, and now it's coming back to haunt me, and I will admit that. Yes, sir. With regard to out-of-pocket expenses, if you look at the Ravel case, I guess what maybe an element of damage would be how much it costs to tear this whole structure down and move it over 2 feet. That's unreasonable. That would be several hundred thousand dollars to tear it down and move it over. I guess a benefit of the bargain would be that it had a value, obviously, of $225, because that's what we had it sold for, and it had no value to the Marasas because they intended to sell it, and the testimony was it could not be sold because of the encroachment. So those are substantially more than the amount of damages that we were asking for. All we were basically asking for was our actual money that we had that we would have gotten out of it, which would have prevented all of these other damages that flowed directly as a result of that. And that's what we were asking for at the time. I would point out with regard to this appraisal, by the way, that the letter as submitted by Mr. Odom specifically states that, this is to the appraiser, I have enclosed a set of the plans and specifications from Sam as to exactly what he intends to do. Now, I understand that this is an appraisal as to what the value would be in the future. Bearing in mind, we were told it was this amount. We're never told it came back at this amount. And in fact, we actually had a sale of $2.5. So that shows that we did it substantially as the plans called for, because that $2.25 is almost identical to the $2.29.
But you paid $1.35 for it.
I understand. Yes, sir. That's at the time we purchased it for the whole land. Yes, sir. And I guess that if you had an automobile case that you believed you're getting an airbag in it, I guess maybe if you had an accident and you found out, lo and behold, you, after you went through the windshield, it really didn't have an airbag in it, then what are your damages? Are your damages maybe the $200 that it would have cost if that car had an airbag in it? Are your damages what you suffered, personal injury and all, when you went flying through the windshield because you relied upon the representation that it had an airbag in it? And I certainly don't feel that you would need to submit a consequential issue to the jury in a case such as that. Gentlemen, I think this is very simple in that as Mr. Milligan has actually told the court, he wants to limit actual damage to anything you can prove exactly in the day you purchase the property. I do not believe that was the intent of the DTPA, and I believe it was the intent that you recover all your actual damages and your losses, and that's what we attempted to do in this case.
Any questions?
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first clause. The court will take a brief recess.
The audience will please rise.